Welcome to Worlds Apart. Western media are now awash with articles about how gravely the Kremlin has miscalculated its strategy in Ukraine, failing to achieve a blitzkrieg and having to adjust its military operation there a couple of times. And yet, Moscow is readying to welcome back some of its historical lands with the overwhelming support of the people who live there. And unlike many of its Western adversaries, it's managed to keep its budget and developmental goals mostly intact. Has Vladimir Putin miscalculated the Western response, or has the West miscalculated Putin's calculations? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Saurabh Gupta, a senior fellow at the Washington-based Institute for China-America Studies. Mr. Gupta, it's a very rare treat for me to speak to anyone who is based in Washington these days, so I'm very grateful for your time, and I'm looking forward to an honest and analytically rather than propaganda-driven conversation.
Thank you for the invitation, Ms. Boyko. I'm looking forward to the conversation too.
Now, you wrote not so long ago that Vladimir Putin, like Joseph Stalin back in the late 1940s, miscalculated in applying quote-unquote brute force to its neighbors. And I'm sure it's a tantalizing and very gratifying comparison for some of your readers, but what makes you believe that Russia as a state in its current form is led by the same expansionist, self-aggrandizing ideological aspirations as the Soviet Union was after the Second World War?
I'll be absolutely frank, it absolutely is not. Russia is a defensive country and a defensive force and is just looking to secure its borders. It is absolutely not the country that the Soviet Union was. And the analogy which I brought in out there in the report that I was written is about how there can be miscalculations in terms of responses from the other side. Even at that point of time, Joseph Stalin did not wish to bring upon the sort of Cold War containment that the Americans brought on. And to be very frank, the Americans overplayed their hand at that point of time in the late 1940s. But America was so powerful at that point of time that it could get away with that and it could create the institutions that it did, you know, the Marshall Plan and the NATO, et cetera, and they were successful. The Americans mistakenly believe that they can do that today. They are not in that position and power to do that today. But that having been said, the analogy that I wanted to bring out here was that Mr. Putin's actions have provoked a response that was unexpected at Moscow's end, and to which to some extent have undercut its broader geopolitical positioning in the international space.
Well, Mr. Gupta, it's pretty clear that any incursion into another country is bound to have pretty serious ramifications, and I think the Kremlin was fully aware of that from the get-go. There's also a lot of discussion here in Russia about how the Ukrainian operation and the very likely admission of the former Ukrainian regions into Russia proper will divert resources from Russia's own domestic policies, for example, the drive to develop the Far East. But there's also recognition that these moves serve key security and national identity goals, repelling NATO, as well as shielding the people of Eastern Ukraine from ethnically motivated persecution. Do you fully dismiss those motives?
No, I don't believe those are fake motives. What I would have actually suggested, if Mr. Putin had this plan, the special military operation, as we've seen, the initial operation went all the way till Kiev. Now, let's step back a moment out here. We had the Minsk Accords, Minsk II in particular, and The irony is that the West was reading of the Russian hymn sheet and telling Ukraine that you must do what is written in Minsk, which is the special status, et cetera, et cetera, enshrine that in the constitution. And I would have suggested that Mr. Putin hammer on those points, that the Minsk Accord, over and over and over, whether it's in the Normandy format, whether it's the clusters proposal, was being violated by Minsk. And that's the reason for an operation which would be limited to the Donbass area. I think the Western response would have been qualitatively different in that regard too. The Western sanctions response, it would not have been a happy response, but it would not have been also as far-reaching. And this is the modus operandi of what the West has done, be it in Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. It has first softened the ground for its own military operation and then gone forward. And so that would be my suggestion in this regard.
Now, you also wrote that one of the most important foresights of the Western architects after the Second World War was their decision to build an international system and an international economic system that was based on openness and universalism, you know, a global economy that could belong to essentially every member of the global community. And I wonder if one of the main underlying factors, not only in the Ukrainian conflict, but in this broader confrontation between Russia and the West, and to some extent the West and the rest, is in fact some presumption, inexplicable presumption on the part of the West that the global economy belongs to the West only, and that it's up to the West to decide who has access to it.
You're absolutely correct, and I stand by what I wrote. I mean, the West designed the plumbing out there, and it pretends that that economic infrastructure plumbing is designed by the West and is owned by the West, and it can shut it off when it wants to. And that's completely wrong, because the U.S. doesn't have that power and capability anymore. And I would add one more feature out here. This is just a sign, you know, in the 1940s, you know, I talked about that comparison with Stalin. The West was confident. When it was confident, it did not have to take this sort of radical action. The fact that it is taking radical action now is itself its lack of confidence that that hegemony that it enjoyed can be perpetuated. And so it is now trying to realize all the gains from underwriting that system on a short-term basis, regardless of whether that system will then can be maintained. So the US is now extracting as much out of that system when it first used to uphold and underwrite that system. And that itself is a reflection of how the West itself feels that its day in the international system is coming to an end.
Speaking about extraction, Mr. Gupta, until recently, the West was indeed capable of extracting whatever it wants from the rest of the world and being unscathed by it. But with this latest confrontation and the policies of sanctions against Russia, it seems that it can no longer shield itself, its own societies, from the consequences of its own action. Have we come to a point, perhaps even a turning point, when the chickens have come home to roost?
Oh, you're correct on that front. I think there has been, from on both sides, I mean, there's mutual damage, and especially in Europe. I think particularly when I look at Germany, I just don't understand that country. 50 years of diplomacy has literally been flushed down the toilet in half a year. And they're going to have a very difficult winter. And yes, there's blowback all around. But I would also submit that this has hurt Russia's standing and Russia's capabilities going forward for some period of time. And so this has not been, it's been lose-lose for both parties, frankly. And time will tell who has lost more in this context.
Well, I know that you have dedicated a lot of years of your career to political risk analysis. So it's not just about wishful thinking or, you know, best hope. It's about calculating, you know, means versus goals, and help us understand that this is one thing that many in Russia are not able to understand. We hear a lot of politicians in the West say that Ukraine needs to be supported until it defeats Russia. What exactly these people mean by defeating Russia, and what kind of risks it involves?
It's a great question. And to be very honest, I have no understanding of what the West is thinking in terms of defeating Russia. What I would submit out here is, well, Ukraine feels there has been a violation of its territory. It deserves a chance to fight back and recoup as much of its territory as it can. This is an inherent right to self-defense. It is an inherent, so it is doing that. It should be given an opportunity. But we'll see how far it goes. I mean, defending territory is a lot easier than capturing territory. The Ukrainians need to recapture territory. And I mean, there's been a lot of glee and jumping around that they've got a little bit of Kherson province and a little bit here and a little bit there. But my argument would be that let them have that one chance, and after it is stalemated, the areas where the stalemate becomes should become more permanent lines across which a peace settlement can then be enforced.
Now, Mr. Gupta, you wrote not so long ago that Russia's quote-unquote invasion of Ukraine is as naked violation of international law as it can be. And I personally agree with you. Although Vladimir Putin, being a legalist, provided or sought to provide some legal justification, people of Donbass officially appealing to Russia for support and protection. But regardless of how weak or how strong that legal justification is, I would argue that international law can only be international and law when it's universally applied, systematically and universally applied. When it's applied selectively, it undermines its very purpose and it becomes a weapon of injustice rather than a means to justice. I simply don't understand why would people still make these arguments about international law? Does international law even matter anymore?
I understand your point. What I would submit would be that, yes, international law has been violated gravely. Let me be very frank about this thing. This is, yes, the most naked violation of international law since Saddam Hussein moved into Kuwait. But there have been many violations of international law by the West and in the intervening time. And the amount of people who have died as a result of that violations of international law are magnitudes higher than what's happening.
Millions and millions of people across the Arab states, across Africa, and frankly, even across Europe.
Precisely. There's no doubt and no question about that. But what I would still submit at this point of time is, if there is going to be something as international order, not liberals rule-based order, which is an anachronism, which is not a very honest characterization. But if there is going to be international order, then international relations must not just be about power and interest, but it should also be about certain loose norms which can be respected by all parties.
And I think most of the decision makers in Moscow would agree with you. I know that you often you often point out that balance is one of the key values in foreign affairs, and I think the Russians ultimately are very Byzantine in their approach. They're all about balancing, and even the Soviet Union, as communist as it was, it knew the art of balancing. But the question is whether the West is open to balancing in any shape or form, because at least from Moscow, it seems that Washington wants everything for itself. It's not interested in any power sharing. Am I wrong on that?
No, you're not wrong on that. You're correct on that. I think George Kennan pointed this out in 1996, that if you are going to take NATO right to Russia's borders, you are going to, the post-war European settlement is going to fail. You know, when President Putin put out those very reasonable demands to the American side in December to President Biden, it was about, let's honor Minsk II. Let's ensure that we have legal guarantees. Let's ensure that that NATO doesn't get until Russia borders. Let's not have offensive weapon systems in adjacent states. I think those were all reasonable and a basis for a conversation. And left to me, I would have said at the end of the end of the Cold War, yes, the Visegrad countries should have been allowed into NATO, but NATO should have been stopped. NATO expansion should have been stopped that moment. Not the Baltics, not even Romania and Bulgaria. And from that point on, the OSCE should have been made as the primary framework within which European security was regulated. For the West, essentially the Cold War didn't end. It was, they told Russia that the Cold War ended for you and you now need to do all these things, but for us, we will continue with our Cold War mentality. And that's and we've come to the logical situation today in seeing what's happening in Ukraine, unfortunately. And the Germans could have done better in Europe. It's like, oh, we cannot talk loudly because of our history, softly. They were the ones against giving NATO a membership action plan, Ukraine a membership action plan, but they did nothing about it, and the Ukrainians kept on asking for more from NATO.
Well, Mr. Gupta, let's discuss the issue of German, purported German rationality after a short break, which we need to take right now, but we'll be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Putin is the aggressor. Today, I'm authorizing additional strong sanctions.
Today, Russia is the country with the most sanctions imposed against it, a number that's constantly growing.
Стратегия сейчас направлена на сокрушение российской экономики, на нанесение максимального ущерба.
We're banning all imports of Russian oil and gas and energy.
Sucks, like we're suffering the price for something that's happening in another country.
Вопрос узловой, который сейчас решается, это судьба доллара как мировой резервной валюты.
Joe Biden, in imposing these sanctions on Russia, you know, has destroyed the American economy. So there's your boomerang effect.
Количество голодающих в Африке вырастет до 100 миллионов человек.
En fait, la situation la plus compliquée, c'est avec les riz et les blés.
Новороссийск глубоководный порт находится под санкциями. Основными морскими портами, которые доставляли зерно, в том числе в Африку, были, конечно, украинские порты, в первую очередь Одесса. Сейчас они заминированы.
Il est évident qu'un pays comme le Soudan, un pays comme la Somalie, un pays comme Djibouti, des pays comme certains pays de l'Afrique du Nord, disons, mais qui sont pas au sud du Sahara, mais qui seront affectés.
До полмиллиарда человек в мире могут остаться без хлеба, потому что не будут доступны минеральные удобрения.
Эффект лавины. Где толстый сохнет, там худой дохнет. Вот это самое происходит с Шри-Ланкой сейчас.
Относительно запрета вывоза этого зерна очень четко ответил наш президент. Любые каналы открыты.
Голод может возникнуть, конечно, потому что это не первый раз в Африке голод, да?
Задача Российской Федерации, как ответственного поставщика продовольствия, эти поставки дружественным странам продолжать.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Saurabh Gupta, a senior fellow at the Washington-based Institute for China-America Studies. Mr. Gupta, before the break, we touched upon the issue of German rationality, and it's true that the Russian-German economic relationship, based primarily on gas, but not only so, has managed to ensure that the Cold War stayed cold. It's not cold anymore. We have a major kinetic conflict in the middle of Europe. And just the other day, I'm sure you heard the news about the explosions at the Nord Stream 1 gas pipeline, which for sure will leave Germany and a number of other countries in a very hard situation energy-wise this winter. Now, as a Russian, I don't care about how Germans warm up their homes, but what I'm really concerned about is the state warfare turning to industrial terrorism tactics. What do you think about it? How worrying is that?
Well, I think it is worrying, and I would say what's more worrying is the fact that German-Russian relations have splintered and splintered so badly, and they've perhaps splintered for quite some time. It'll take a lot of effort to repair that relationship. And it's akin some ways to the US-China relationship and the US pushing for decoupling And the damage that that can do, not just to the bilateral relationship, but to the broader global economy. I thought Russia-German relations was the ballast for economic security in Europe, and that ballast has gone. And it's now uncertain as to what sort of a profile, what sort of a country Germany itself will be. We're suddenly seeing a Germany which wants to speak up, talk out, and do things. And of course, it's going to be hurt economically, but I think it has really hurt its long-term foreign policy by seeking a policy of bad relations with Russia. I think it could have done a lot more to preserve that relationship, but to preserve that relationship would have required to be aggressive much earlier and say, this is utter nonsense to have folks like the Ukrainians into NATO. We just don't oppose their membership action plan. We oppose the request for them to join NATO because this is nothing but a provocation. But the Germans didn't do that. And now they themselves are going, as I said, going to see the ramifications of 50 years of wise diplomacy just go down the tube.
Now, I think there is a feeling here in Russia that Germans and to a larger extent the West has taken both Russia and China for granted as a sort of the underpinning, the base for the industrial might. It's very easy to ignore the basement of a house when you only look at the roof or the walls, but many would argue that access to relatively affordable Russian energy sources, some would even say cheap energy sources, was the very basis for German economy. Do you think, in terms of economic analysis, do you think the Europeans understand how much they actually depended, how much their well-being depended on Russia?
Up to a point, I'm assuming that they did know about how much they depended, but they thought that there are certain values and rules and norms that needed to be defended regardless, and so they chose to do that. And unfortunately, everybody's going to live out the consequences of that. And so I would say that it's not a knee-jerk reaction from the Europeans, but I would have hoped that they might have been much more wiser in which they had parlayed their counter sanctions, because these are effectively, I mean, the equivalent of nuclear sanctions on Russia. And they cannot expect then that normal business intercourse, at least in terms of energy supply, would operate.
But Mr. Gupta, I would understand that some of Russia's actions may seem extremely distasteful to the Europeans or to somebody else, but the Europeans also have to deal with the Americans. And some of the American policies vis-a-vis Europe are hard to describe as friendly. And even if we look at this latest attack on the Nord Stream pipeline, which has not been attributed firmly to anyone yet, but we've seen former Polish foreign minister Radek Sikorski thanking America for blowing up the Russian pipeline, bringing gas to Germany. I mean, I understand that they would be extremely angry with Russia and they would feel the need to stand up for certain values. But what about America? Don't they need to stand up for the same values with their closest ally?
Yes, they do. But, America's alliances are alliances of convenience when it wants it to be an alliance. And it can, Americans operate like that. And yes, I mean, the defense guarantees will stay. The defense part of it is firm and unshakable. But on all other fronts, I mean, the Americans are competing as much with the Europeans as they're competing with other people. And we'll see that, if we have an America First president in 2024 and 2028, I mean, policy might change and might change pretty radically in this regard. And the Europeans then will be on their own trying to figure out their own destiny. And they're burning down their own bridges at this point of time.
They had their warning with Donald Trump, which gave him a very comfortable time to acquire a certain degree of autonomy, if not sovereignty, both economic and political. And they attempted to do that. There was some lip service from President Macron and from then leadership of Germany, but it all seemed to evaporate very quickly when Joe Biden came back to office. Now, let me ask you about the American thinking, because you are in Washington, after all, and you're more exposed to their mentality. I think many people here in Russia believe that American decision makers have lost any existential fear. That the reason why they behave in this extremely provocative manner, not only vis-a-vis Russia, but also with regards to their own population, is simply because they have absolutely no accountability. Do you agree with that? And does Russia have any option of bringing that message home to the decision makers in Washington without threatening the entire world? That is, without using a nuclear option.
No, I think it's going to be difficult, and it gets dangerous to go down the talk of a nuclear option, because the way it is received out here is that this is irresponsible talk and irresponsible action.
Of course it's irresponsible, but you know, sending weapons that kill our servicemen is also irresponsible. Blowing up a major gas pipeline is not an example of the best behavior. So, I mean, you have to respond to other acts of irresponsibility, provided that you do that in a moral way that respects the rest of the world.
What I would say is, you know, what the Americans ultimately are trying to do is move NATO as far up right to Russia's border.
Just
create insecurity in Russia, and perhaps hope for regime change in Russia, and hope that a super liberal administration then follows in its wake. And I would submit that Russia, as a great power, must be able to hold the lines that it has, new lines that it has drawn in Ukraine, and create a stalemate out there. Because once we have a stalemate and winter comes out there, the call will, I think there will be a crescendo sooner or later, and after winter, with all the hardships that are going to happen, that we need to have some form of a peace settlement.
There's one very well-respected political analyst here in Moscow, Dmitry Trenin, who used to be very well-received in Washington. And he said the other day that even though Vladimir Putin is pretty straightforward in communicating Russian red lines, he said there is simply no space in Washington playbook for Russian or, in fact, any other nation's red lines. In fact, when Moscow tries to draw any limits, people in Washington believe that their obligation is to show very publicly, to demonstrate it to Moscow to the point of humiliation, that its sensibilities simply don't count. Am I right on that?
More or less, you are correct on that. But I would say, I mean, we have seen some limits of where the U.S. has gone up to and stopped. The U.S. has not been U.S. is a de facto participant in the war, and I think to this day it provides a lot of very significant intelligence support, which has not been reported much. But the U.S. has not itself got engaged physically in terms of, in a kinetic way, in terms of the war. So it does understand where those limits are. And also, as we saw earlier, it ensured that there would be no action from a NATO state. The armaments would be sent into Ukraine, and then Ukraine can do stuff, but it should not target Russian territory, even though it has targeted some on the boundaries. So there are limits, and that's some amount of limits.
Mr. Gupta, you say that there are limits, and yet quite clearly they are not really being observed. I wonder if those limits are imposed for the sake of the United States itself, so that, you know, President Biden can tell the American people that, okay, we are not participating, even though everybody knows that the Americans are in Kyiv, that they are advising the Ukrainian military leadership, that they're providing all the satellite data, that they're providing weapons. Is it really authentic to argue that they are no longer part of direct party to this conflict?
You can make a borderline case that yes, that they are a party to this conflict in a full-fledged way, but they also aren't, because they themselves are not directly involved. And as I said, their goal is to take it all up to NATO, to Russia's border, and create insecurity in Russia. And as I said, the Cold War never ended for the U.S. This is just part of the prosecution of that Cold War, which they don't want to get hot from their perspective. But as you said, they're willing to fight with the last Ukrainian soldier.
Well, if they're willing to take NATO all the way up to Russia's borders, do you think it would be a wise strategy on the part of Russia to take that war closer to the American homeland? I'm thinking about industrial infrastructure. I'm thinking about all kinds of special forces operations. I'm thinking about even targeting American forces in third countries, and perhaps a credible threat of a nuclear strike on the American homeland. Do you think something like that could bring those people in check with reality?
Yeah, but I think we'll cross an important line if there's a direct exchange between the Russians and the Americans, or Russians and a NATO state. I think that line needs to be preserved, because if that line is violated, I think we could be in for a conflagration. And so I think there's some element of even self-restraint from the Russian end which needs to happen. And that's why I said, I mean, the real concentration should have from day one should have been about Donbass. And even today, it should be about preserving front lines in Donbass and leave matters at that.
Well, Mr. Gupta, I hope your advice is heeded. For the time being, we have to leave it there. But I'm very, very grateful for your participation. Thank you very much for that.
You're most welcome. Thank you, Ms. Parker. It's a pleasure speaking to you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.